Always Leave podcast, home to stories that haunt. These stories may contain graphic depictions of violence or explicit language. Listener discretion is advised.
Cindy, you lazy slut, get in here!
I was already on the stairs when I heard Joyce shouting. Her voice cracked and weak, but her sentiments as brutal as ever. I'm coming, Grandma, I called back as I climbed. She responded with a mercifully inaudible grumbling. Her tone strained with a high note of pain. I brought the tray into the room and set it down on her dresser, then went to open the curtains.
I'm wet,
she spat as I let the light come flooding in.
If you moved that fat ass a bit faster, I'd have been able to hold it.
The doctor had offered to place an indwelling catheter, but she was resistant. I didn't blame her. Those things pinched like hell. But at the same time, she literally had no control anymore. And I was changing sheets 5 or more times every day. We had taken to layering them up with mattress protectors, one after another, to save time stripping them off all day. I went back to the dresser and took out a new nightdress and underwear, and looked at the porridge I'd brought her on its tray and sighed internally. By the time I'd got her and the bed clean and dry, it would be cold, and she didn't want to eat much of it hot. She'd refuse it completely cold. Oh well, I thought, heading to the ensuite for some warm water and a washcloth. Guess I'll be making second breakfast today. Once she was changed and settled back on clean sheets, I fetched and spoon-fed her soaked grape nuts and helped her sip coffee from a cup with a spout.
This tastes like shit,
she croaked between spoons.
I don't know why you don't just starve me instead of feeding me this crap. You just like to see me suffer.
When she had grudgingly taken 4 or 5 bites, enough to line her stomach, I began to give her meds. Each pill washed down with sips of water from a Stanley cup my teenager had thoughtfully left as a gift on her bedside. Joyce had received it with a glower and,
Your generation sure love to buy a lot of crap, don't you?
I dumped all the pills from the sorter into my palm and put them on her tongue one by one. One to lower her blood pressure, one to make her failing heart work harder, one to control her blood sugars, one to impede the growth of the tumors. Not that the last one seemed to be working. When I got to the last two, both painkillers of slightly different mechanisms, she gritted her dentures together and turned her head away. Please, Grandma, I said. You're in pain. I can hear it in your voice.
You think I'm weak,
she said.
But I'm a lot stronger than you. Pathetic. Elaine seems to have grown a spine, at least.
My mother Elaine had been notably absent throughout Grandma's decline. When we were young, she had always told my brothers and I, My mom is a tricky character. Or, we're just very different people. And I was grown before I knew the truth, which was that Grandma is just an evil old bitch.
You probably think she's avoiding me,
Joyce went on.
But I'm just a good excuse. It's you she can't look at. Her own daughter. Fat. Ugly, dumb, weak.
She spat the word through a snarl of disdain.
If you'd been mine, I'd have drowned you. Put you in the fire with the afterbirth.
I sighed inside again and put the pain meds back in the pill sorter. I'd try again with them later. Sometimes the agony nibbled away at her enough that she'd take them in the afternoon.
You don't even argue.
She was relentless.
What's wrong with you? Too stupid to defend yourself?
I'm going to go do the dishes, I replied. If you need me, just speak. I'll hear you. And I nodded at the baby monitor on her bedside.
I'm not a fucking infant,
I heard as I left, then mumbling as I went down the stairs, and as I came into the kitchen where the receiving monitor sat on the table.
Fat, useless slut, listening in all day and doing nothing. Stuffing her fat face, pretending she's doing a shift, caring for me.
I turned the volume down a bit and started unloading the dishwasher. This had been going on for weeks. She'd had the third fall at home in April, come to stay here in the middle of May, and now it was almost July. The first two falls she'd managed to refuse treatment for, but the third had broken her pelvis. At first, the doctors had said that it was her age, and osteoporosis was common in elderly ladies. But then they'd done an x-ray and found her bones were leached of strength because they were full of tumors, which had spread to almost every part of her. Not her brain, yet. Nor her voice box. I love my mom. I understood completely why she couldn't care for Joyce, who had given her a miserable childhood and then thrown her out of the house at 16. Not for any discernible reason. Mom hadn't been pregnant or using drugs or getting into trouble. She'd been a straight-A student. Now I'd been living with Joyce for a few weeks, I thought I knew why. It was because Mom had a way out. College beckoned, and she was clever enough to get a full scholarship somewhere far away. And Joyce couldn't have an escapee, couldn't tolerate being left. So she threw Mom out first. I had no idea where the bitterness that leaked from Joyce like juice from an overripe fruit had come from. Her own mother, my great-grandma Bibiana, had been a lovely woman. She had come in from Europe somewhere as a soft-spoken, gentle 25-year-old. In the old country, she'd been an assistant to the traditional midwife and acted as a sort of unofficial nurse to the sick and disabled. When she'd first arrived here, she and her husband, my great-grandfather, Thomasu, had opened a small deli and made enough to keep their seven sons and one daughter dressed and fed. In fact, their shop, Bibby's, was still going, though it wasn't in the family anymore. Joyce had left home at 18 and almost never spoke to her parents and siblings again. Perhaps there was some invisible hurt there that was the root of it all. I had barely known Joyce existed when I was a child. My mother, once evicted, had managed to find her uncles and grandparents, who had taken her in immediately. And it was they who had fulfilled the grandparenting role in mine and my brother's childhoods. I didn't meet Joyce until I was a teenager, and Bibby had died. Joyce had come to the funeral, dressed in a bright summer dress and red stilettos, a slash of crimson lipstick across her sneering face. After the coffin had gone into the ground, and we had all filed past to drop rose petals and a handful of earth in, she had marched over to where we stood and said to my mother,
"That was a cheap service, Elaine. The coffin looked like the high school shop class made it. I guess that college education didn't work out so great for you."
And walked away again. That was our introduction. I can't explain to you how we ended up nursing Joyce. Kindness. I suppose that's the answer. My mother and Bibby and Tom and all the uncles had absolutely stuffed myself and my siblings full of kindness. It had flowed from her like the poison flowed from Joyce. No, through her. Bibby was the wellspring. Goodness and generosity and love. Joyce was our bad apple, and we refused to be spoiled by her. She was ours, we couldn't change that. But we could choose how to respond to her. And we chose to love. To care for her the way we would choose, and not the way she perhaps deserved. And the terrible childhood wasn't why my mother wasn't doing the physical caring. Really, Mom wasn't doing the physical caring because it made Joyce so distressed to be cared for by her. She insulted me, called me names, said horrible things, threw things back when she was able. But acts of service or kindness from Elaine had a much more dramatic effect. The irritation became rage. The cruelty became vitriol. My tolerance of her sparked anger in Joyce. My mother's was like dumping gas on the sparks. That shriveled old heart that needed drugs to keep it shifting the blood would have exploded with wrath if my mother had been the one caring for it. So Mom kept a distance, provided me with a shoulder to cry on, helped pay for the laundry service and the extra food, arranged and kept track of the appointments, and organized my brothers and their families into a meal train and babysitting service to give me time off and try to keep me sane. It gave her a sense of satisfaction that we all shared, that we could love way harder than Joyce could hate. July dragged into August, and the decline went on. Cancer is an unspeakable cruelty, a voracious, merciless, venomous, evil of a disease. Watching it consume even this hateful twist of a woman was dreadful. It gave her no peace. She also gave herself no peace and rejected pain medications long after the agony of it had limited every part of her existence. She couldn't move, eat, evacuate, speak, or breathe without intense pain when she finally started opening her mouth for the occasional sip of liquid morphine. It was the middle of August when she began speaking in tongues. That's what we joked it was back then. The first time it happened, I was out. Mom had arranged for Justin to come sit with Joyce while I took my older two kids to an orthodontist appointment and for some lunch. And we were sitting in a small pizzeria finishing our drinks when my mobile rang.
Cindy, does she speak Italian to you?
His voice had been crackly, the signal not great.
What?
I'd switched the phone to my other ear, pressed the volume up button a few times.
I said, does she speak Italian to you?
No, I'd said. I don't think she can. I don't think they were taught it. Bibby and Tom wanted them to blend in. That's why all the kids had such American names.
Well, she's speaking it, I think.
He sounded amazed and worried.
She keeps saying, sounds like a gabadora? Any ideas? She's not very clear.
A gabadora? I thought about it. Means nothing to me, sorry. Have you tried the web?
Yeah,
he sighed.
Nothing comes up. Google Translate just gives me the same words back that I put in, no matter how I spell it.
Well, you want me to come back? I eyed the menu sadly. I've been planning a Sunday.
No!
His voice was suddenly sharp and clear.
God no, stay out, enjoy yourself. It was just in case it was a drink or a snack or something I could get her. Take your time. I'll see you when you get back.
It began to happen more and more after that. She would grasp my wrist in her bird-like claw of a hand when I was wiping her face, staring at me with frantic eyes. Or start out of a sleep when I was quietly folding an extra quilt over her. Or, worst of all, at 3 a.m., her demand crackling through the baby monitor, dragging me from sleep with a jolt.
"Agabatora!"
she would hiss with urgency.
"Please, Cindy! Please!"
But we couldn't figure out what it meant. Obviously, it meant something to her. And we joked that she was speaking in tongues. It was the last thing she ever said. Agabadora. A final plaintive moan of a word. A prayer to an unknown god. Made almost unintelligible by her lack of teeth and refusal to take the clattering lumps of her dentures into her shriveled mouth. It came wheezing out of her late one morning in early September. She fell into unconsciousness not long after, but lived another 4 days. How? I do not know. She must have weighed less than 60 pounds by then, and she'd been refusing liquids for a few days already. Mom did come then, and we took turns so that someone was sitting with her around the clock. She died right when dinner was being made, which meant nobody got to eat it in the flurry of having the death certified and laying her out. Most fitting, this final, small, sad inconvenience she caused us all. But she died with my brother Luke holding her hand and my teenager reading Mary Oliver's Wild Geese aloud to her, and we, at least, were satisfied. She had died, which we all must do, surrounded by comforts and warmth despite the chill she herself exuded. Love had won out. She went into the ground beside Tom and Bibby and three of her brothers, and for a few months she seemed to rest in peace. Then, not long after the new year began, she began to torment me again. After she had died, her belongings, she had no wealth to speak of, had been passed out among the rest of us. Quilts and tea sets, silver jewelry and prayer bowls, and astonishingly, a set of healing crystals. I let everyone else pick before me, having kind of had enough of her at that moment, and ended up with everything no one else wanted. Some costume rings made of, I think, tin. A selection of ugly silk scarves, too light to be warm and too small to be useful. 3 large totes full of hideous old fabrics and smelly wool batting and other quilting supplies. And a crate with a jumble of unidentified knickknacks. That was my favorite, because I like to think about things and almost everything in there demanded some thought, especially now that Joyce was dead and I couldn't ask her about any of it. There was a pack of tarot cards with 3 missing. I didn't know which 3, and I kept meaning to Google a full pack to figure it out, but didn't get around to it. A thing that looked like a donut, but made of highly polished wood. Too large to be a bracelet, too small to be a crown. A round brass thing with prongs that perplexed my husband so much he went away to research and found out it was an elephant claw prayer bell. A highly polished and stained wooden thing that looked like a hammer made from a branch from limb intersection of some hardwood tree. A small hinged box with a bosun's whistle nestled in crushed velvet inside. And lots besides. Odd little things of unknown use or history. In quiet moments, I would take an item out, hold it, examine it, think about what it was for, how Joyce had acquired it. It was through these items of hers that the torment began. First, it was the thimbles, 1 metal, 1 leather. In life, she had used them to preserve her fingertips when she made her quilts. It might seem an odd hobby for such a bitter woman, but Anyone who has ever listened in to a Quilt Guild meeting will recognize the pool of vitriol some of those groups are swimming in. I had found the thimbles one day and slipped them onto the middle and index finger of my left hand. I'd been doing the sort of housework that involves moving dozens of things from the rooms they were left in to the rooms they belong in. I was nearly finished and saw them lying on the dining table. I put them on and walked my fingers down the tabletop, the metal making a clear click and the leather a softer tap. Click, tap, click, tap, click, tap, down the table. Then my mobile rang, and it was a client, so I went to my office to take the call, waking my laptop up with a shake of the mouse, slipping the thimbles off and leaving them there next to the mouse mat. The next day, I noticed them missing. I didn't give it a second thought. I just noticed and figured a kid had moved them, or I had and had forgotten. But then I found them again, standing together neatly on the edge of a step halfway up the stairs. At the time, I just picked them up and put them back with the quilting supplies, but I couldn't stop thinking about them. How did they get there? The dog, a farting old English bulldog, would have swallowed them before she put them on the stairs. The kids were too old to have thought lining them up on the stairs was amusing. I asked my husband about it, and he just shook his head and suggested I'd somehow picked them up, stuck to the bottom of a plate perhaps, or caught on my sleeve in some way, and dropped them. But I decided the chance of me dropping them so that they landed the same way up, neatly beside one another on the very edge of a step, was vanishingly small. They soon disappeared from the quilting supplies box again, and over the following weeks I found them in various places. Inside a teapot, on the top edge of a bedroom door, inside the toe of a rubber boot one rainy day. It started to irritate me. I quizzed the kids, who denied everything, but the 12-year-old was going through a weird phase. Perhaps it was her. Then tin rings began to show up in weird places. In the drawer with the knives. In my water glass beside my bed. One was inside a Coke bottle, though the neck was too narrow for it to fit through. I broke the bottle to retrieve it. Although she'd been a bitch, I wanted to hold her memory in fondness, not throw it away with her wandering belongings. Then I began to find tarot cards all over the house. And it reminded me of a podcast I'd listened to where the finder of a tarot card was offered unimaginable success and wealth, but then had to pay the price in terrible misfortune. But nothing like that happened to me. My Son of Cups floated in the guest bathroom toilet. The Hanged Man dangled by one foot inside the coffee pot. The Ace of Clubs lay on my pillow. The Magician surfed on a tide of Cheerios from the box into my breakfast bowl. Then it was the wooden hammer. I thought it was a hammer anyway. That's what it looked like. I didn't notice it disappearing. It had been on a high shelf of a bookcase, above my eyeline. But I knew, when I found it in the drawer with the wooden spoons and potato masher and balloon whisk, that I hadn't put it there. I returned it to the bookcase. A few days later, it was in the footwell of my car. I had parked the car in the garage that night, which was rare. I usually left it in the driveway. I told the kids off for that one. I told them that if I'd not noticed it and it had gotten under my brake pedal, it could have killed me. They stared, blinking, the youngest looking first at his siblings, then at me, trying to work out if this was a joke he wasn't in on. It was then I had to begin to admit it really wasn't them. It was Joyce. It was as if me acknowledging it, even though it was only internally, incited her in some way. The movements became more and more sinister. The death card appeared at the bottom of my bowl of Italian wedding soup. I almost choked on a ring that had found its way into my coffee. The elephant claw prayer bell inexplicably rolled from the landing above the staircase, missing my skull by an inch as it fell, leaving a fist-sized bruise on the top of my shoulder. I decided it was time to seek advice. Joyce is haunting me. Mom's face remained calm as I spoke, and I paused to see how she would respond. "Go on," she said after a moment. "That's it. She's haunting me. She's moving her stuff around. At first, it just felt like she wanted my attention, but now I don't know. What's changed?" Her head was tilted in curiosity. "I don't know." I struggled to articulate the feeling the objects had begun to give me. "It's sinister now. At first, she was just moving things around. Now it feels like she's trying to hurt me." I told her about the hammer in the footwell, the ring in the coffee, showed her the splash of purple on my poor shoulder. "She probably just doesn't like you thinking her stuff is yours. But I think you should try and talk to Uncle Joe," she said after a pause. "He knew Joyce best. Maybe he will be able to help." Uncle Joe. My great Uncle Joseph is Joyce's eldest brother and the oldest child of Tom and Bibby still alive. He's 102 and lives in a care home out east on the coast. Nobody is sure if he's actually got dementia because he's always been quite a cryptic sort of man. He was the second of their 8 children and so far had outlived the 1st, 4th, 7th, and 8th. Joyce had been the 4th, and Joe was 6 years her senior. We drove the 2 hours to see him that weekend, myself and Mom. I brought with me some flowers and a bag of Bibby's deli foods I knew he used to love. Pimento olives and octopus salad, and those little pasta dumplings I always forget the name of and have to read off the label under the glass counter, sounding it out like a child. Couleur Jeunesse. When we arrived, Joe was in what the staff called the day room, a long, bright gallery of a place with pink walls, floor-to-ceiling windows all down one side, facing onto a neat garden and armchairs in clusters around low coffee tables. He smiled widely at Mom when he saw us.
"Elaine."
His wrinkled face smoothed substantially, stretched by a huge smile. His voice surprisingly strong, coming from his wizened frame.
"And you brought your little one."
I rolled my eyes at this, laughing. "Hi, Uncle Joe," I said, sitting down. A staff member came then and offered us coffee, and I thought it was a pretty fancy place, as I accepted, and they bustled away to fetch it.
"Your mother says my sister is haunting you."
Joe was straight to the point. "I brought you some food," I said, not ready to get to all that yet. But when I opened the bag to bring his food out, there it was. The head of it tucked between the octopus and the olives. That fucking hammer. I pulled it out and dropped it on the table with a clatter. Joe's face blanched.
"Why have you brought this?"
he whispered. "I didn't," I cried, continuing to bring the foods out and put them on the table in front of him. "This sort of thing is why I'm here. I don't even know what it is. It's one of the things she's tormenting me with. She keeps moving all her stuff around in my house, and now she's sent this thing with me today." Joe nodded slowly.
"Well,"
he was almost whispering,
"this you must first put away."
I was surprised by his visible fear of the thing, but swiped it off the table and dropped it back into the now empty tote bag.
"Joyce was always so difficult,"
Joe said.
"I don't know why. She was always that way. A dissatisfied baby, an angry toddler, a sullen child. For her, nothing was good enough, yes. She was too good for the family and disgusted to find herself in it."
He paused as the staff member placed a tray of coffees, sugar and cream on the side, down in front of us.
It was as if every tiny event of her life was like a splinter in her flesh, and she could never release it nor forget the discomfort it brought.
You mean she bore a grudge? I asked. Joe nodded.
Like nothing else on earth can. Look at your mother,
he said, smiling at Mom.
Our beautiful Elaine. Clever, kind, happy. But Joyce could not stand her. Could not stand to see her move happily in the world. She tried all the time Elaine was young to destroy her. And when she could not, she threw her away. It was as if she could only be happy when another was not.
We drank coffee in silence for a while, and then Joe asked me what I'd brought, and I showed him each container. Then he eyed the tote again warily, and I asked, "What is it? Is it a hammer?" He nodded slowly.
"Of a sort,"
he said.
"Let me see again."
I took it back out and offered it to him, but he shook his head and nodded, indicating I should put it on the table. He considered it for a long time and then began to speak again.
"In the old country, there was a kind of woman,"
he began. "In Italy?" I asked, cursing myself inside for interrupting, but I knew so little about the family history.
"Sardinia,"
Joe said, and I saw Mom's head tilt with interest. So she hadn't known this either.
"In the old country, in the hinterlands, that is, the places inland where it was hard to get to, where the roads were impassable in winter, or where there were no roads, there was a kind of a woman. She was a widow, most usually. She was a cabadora, the one who takes away pain."
"A cabadora?" I was almost shouting.
"You know this?"
Joe asked, his eyes widening in surprise.
"Yes! No! Joyce kept saying it the last few weeks. We couldn't find out what she meant. It was the last thing she said to me."
He shook his head sadly.
"She must have been in such pain,"
he said,
"to ask for this."
"But what is it?" I asked. "What is a gabadora? How does she take the pain? We had morphine. Most of the time, she wouldn't take it."
"No,"
Joe said slowly, trying to help me understand.
"A gabadora takes away pain forever."
I frowned, struggling to understand.
"It is like this. The pain is too great. The person cannot bear it. In the hinterlands, the doctor cannot come because there is no road. And so, the family go out. Leave the doors open. Ask the Acabadora to visit. She comes with that."
He pointed with a twisted finger.
"It is olive wood. Very hard, very strong. And..."
He raised the hand and swept it sharply.
"She strikes. Just here."
He raised the hand to his neck just below the skull.
"And takes the pain away for good."
"Murder? Euthanasia?"
Mom and I had spoken together.
"Euthanasia,"
Joe said, nodding at my mom.
"She comes only by invitation. Only when there is no choice. Only when the patient requests it. She is an angel of mercy and of comfort. The final mother in life, bringing relief. That is how Mama told it. These women were often also the same who ushered new life in as midwives.
But, so, I was confused. Why did Joyce have this? She was the least merciful woman I've ever met.
This was from my mama, from Bibby,
he said.
She was a midwife back in the old country, but not a widow, not a cabadora. She was gifted this on the death of Fedula, the old woman who taught her midwifery. And Joyce got it when Bibby died, because she was the only daughter.
So why is she haunting me? I asked, but I knew the answer already.
She suffered,
Joe said.
And she is not a woman who would willingly suffer alone.
Mom and I decided to throw it all away. We talked it over on the way home and decided it was probably the only solution. We would gather up everything that had been Joyce's and take it all to Goodwill. The tarot cards and the hammer, as tragic as that felt when it had been the tool of women who wielded it with mercy and love, we would burn. Driving back, I had intended to do it at once, as soon as I got in. But then we arrived and the teenager had cooked, so we ate dinner. All of us. And after, when the kids had left the table, we told my husband everything Joe had said. And something about telling it made it seem slightly absurd. You know how that goes, right? When something feels so true, so solid in your mind, but as soon as you say it out loud to someone new, all these holes begin to appear in it, as if it's being eaten by moths in front of your eyes. Soon, only shreds of it, of your belief in it, remain. By the time Mom was getting ready to leave, the hammer was back on the bookcase, and I was thinking about the pieces I would take to Goodwill, like the fabric. By the time I climbed into bed, I felt almost embarrassed about the events of that day. I woke disoriented, slightly dizzy. What time was it? I wanted to look at my phone, sitting charging on my bedside, but I couldn't make my head turn, my limbs move. I blinked, trying to make out the details of my room, but it was unusually dark. My heart was beating rapidly, and I scanned my body, wondering why I couldn't move. Sleep paralysis, I remembered. That's what they called it when you got trapped between sleep and waking. Your mind is awake, but your motor functions stay asleep. It's okay, I told myself. You're okay, Cindy. Time stretches, it feels like a long time, but it's only a few seconds. You'll wake fully in just a few seconds. I waited, willing my galloping heart to steady, but it just went on racing and skipping, thudding against my ribs. Gradually, I could see something. I had my head turned to the side, my right ear buried in the pillow. And this thing was only in my peripheral vision. I couldn't figure out what it was. It wasn't moving. Maybe it was the light fitting, I mused. My eyes ached from straining to see it. Maybe it was part of the sleep paralysis. Don't some people dream there's a devil sat on their chest? Then directly in front of me, beyond the shadowy topography of my sleeping husband's shoulder and head, I saw some tiny lights. Impossibly bright in the darkness. They lit up in a little arc. Two green, one yellow. I stared, trying to make sense of them. What was over there? An alarm clock? They came on and went off. Came on and went off. Lighting up gradually from green through to yellow, and then blinking off from yellow back to green. The thing above me moved slightly then. I still couldn't see it well. I still was frozen in place, my muscles deeply asleep. But whatever it was seemed to rotate a little. Smoothly. Slowly. The lights lit up again, and this time there were more. And there was a little red light, too, at the end of the row after the yellows. There was a soft hissing crackle, and I realized what it was. It was the baby monitor. But that couldn't be, I thought. It wasn't plugged in. The other part of it was right beside it, also unplugged, batteries removed. But no, that mustn't be right, because it was the baby monitor I was hearing. Seeing. The lights lit up again, and the static crackled and coughed. My heart skipped and raced. The thing above me was moving again. What was that? All I could see was a thin, gleaming line, rotating slowly up above me.
Cindy!
It came in a crackly hiss from the monitor. It was Joyce's voice. Thin and wheedling, pained and enraged.
Agabadora!
It accused.
Agabadora!
There was a cold draft of air which swept across my body, so that my nipples hardened painfully and goose flesh rose all over me. As the chill was shivering through, it seemed like a tidal wave of pain crashed down onto me and swept me away. My bones screamed. My organs were a knotted jumble of spasms and stabs. Every joint burned hot and aching. My stomach gnawed, nauseated and eating itself, and a desperate, terrible thirst closed my throat and stuck my tongue to the roof of my mouth. It was an unimaginable, all-encompassing agony. Every cell, every atom of me screamed and clawed, and my mind roiled, desperate for escape. Wake up! I shouted desperately inside my head. Wake up! Wake up! The lights were lighting up again. I watched them through the reddish haze of pain that had further dimmed my vision. The crackle rose to a word again. This time, it wheedled a mocking, sarcastic question.
Agabadora!
I fought to speak, to answer, but only a muffled, squeaking sob escaped my throat. Then the thing above me rotated again, and revealed itself to be the hammer, wielded by an invisible hand. There were the lights again, and a rhythmic hissing from the monitor, which I realized was Joyce's idea of laughter. Then there was a brief flash just at the corner of my left eye, as the head of the hammer came down, fast and true, against the back of my neck, where it met my skull.
Was written by Beck Stranger and narrated by Kay Weaver. For more stories that haunt, as well as a behind-the-scenes look at what we do and why we do it, you can join our Patreon at patreon.com/pleaseleavepod. You can follow Please Leave on Facebook and Instagram at pleaseleavepod. Our email is pleaseleavepod@gmail.com, and our website is pleaseleavepod.com. This has been a Please Leave Media production.